Okay, just so you know, so we don't, you're welcome to come in 2 weeks to have coffee, but I will not be here in 2 weeks. Next week's our last week, so, and I'm not quite sure which guy we're going to do yet. I've got two candidates, so. As I've done in the past, I just want to remind us by going back over a little bit. We spent some time last week looking at this obscure character in the New Testament whose name only appears really once, and but in a very pejorative, a very powerful way, named Esau, and talked about this issue of godlessness last week. Just 4 points to hit on those real quick, and we'll move on to one of the most amazing relationships in the Bible. First thing we had said last week, that godlessness, and I had made this a point at the end, but I'm putting it at the beginning because I wanted to say it last week, so that if nothing else, you'd remember that, because it's typically we remember the last thing. It's one of the most common and serious sins among respectable Christians. It's not dripping with soot and sulfur and smell and odor and visible to everybody, but this idea of what it is, we said last week, was that godlessness is this attitude that that basically treats the voice of God like just one among many options. That God is vernacularized. God is, in a sense, paganized. He becomes the threshold. The Greek word babelos that's used for godlessness, I think I mentioned this last week, but it's a Greek word that's ancient word that means the threshold. It means to kind of walk on something. As you walk over your door, as you're going into your house, you cross the threshold and you step on it. You don't think anything of it. And that's basically what it means. It means to make God like one of the guys. And so it's kind of a smorgasbord recreational approach to obedience. Kind of pick and choose, do what you feel. Not a compelling voice. Ted Koppel, I forget where he was speaking, he was doing a graduation announcement, and he said that truth in its purest form is a howling reproach, not a polite tap on the shoulder. He said what Moses brought down from Sinai were not the 10 suggestions. And I think there's a sense in which godlessness just disregards that God's voice does not have the power and authority. And we had said last week that basically it's excluding God from places where he belongs. It's keeping God out of my decision making, out of my planning, out of my budgeting, out of what I plan to do with my life. This is something that's not so much an issue to me because I don't have an option on this, but the more I talk to with folks my age, the idea of retirement and what they're going to do with the last whatever chapter of their life that they think they have, sometimes they don't get even a fraction of it. And I think a godless attitude there for us as men would be for us to just believe that God wants us to spend the last chunk of our lives just pursuing personal pleasure. I think to not even entertain the possibility of where I am in life right now, the time that I have, the assets that I have, what God might want me to do. There's a whole movement among retirement age believers of what they call last chapter missions, which is really a neat concept of self-supporting individuals that are going for periods of time to do work, even in rural U.S., but just taking the last time they have to do kingdom work. I think I don't know if you read much of John Piper or what you think of him. He's a pretty prophetic voice, but he has a book out called Don't Waste Your Life, and in the book there's a section in there where he says that when we stand before God as men and God asks us to give an account for the last chunk of time that he gave us, he said, I don't think he's going to be interested in seeing our seashell collection. You know, so I think we've got to entertain that aspect of idea, or the idea of whether or not my plans for the last chapter of my life are including God, or just if he's not even been in the equation. And this goes back to, I think, the bottom line here is that a verse that Paul said in 1 Timothy 2:16, he said, avoid godless chatter because it leads to more and more ungodliness. And we had said last week that a godless mouth eventually produces an ungodly life. And so the conversations I have with people that are dear to me, how I talk, and where God fits into that equation. I remember doing, I used to do things like this just spontaneously as a teacher, because I taught in a Christian schools in Colorado and here, probably representing close to 400 different churches over 25 years that fed their kids into these two schools. So I had a really good window into the future of the church as well as the heart of the church. And I did a survey once and asked how many of my students' fathers had ever prayed with them. And it was under 5% of their dads that had ever sat on the edge of their bed and just prayed with them. And I think this idea of godlessness is something that we can pass on to our children by not them not watching us, them not participating with us as dads or as even as husbands for that matter, in bringing the Lord into stuff. I know I did a men's retreat a couple weeks ago, and we were talking a little bit about conflict, and my wife Jill has got an amazing, and I think I even shared that with this group, but when we get into a conflict, sometimes she'll look at me and say, "Where's God in all this?" All right? That's the opposite of godlessness right there. Just that little statement is that all of a sudden I've got to answer that question and deal with the fact, what have I done with God? And the truth is, He's out here, you know. I've got a conflict with you. God's has nothing to do with this. You know, leave Him out of this. Don't drag Him into this. This is our problem. And so this is a big deal for us. It's a subtle thing. It's a respectable thing. You know, I can be the cleanest knife in the drawer and have just a really good moral life. But if God's not at least in my thinking, part of my decision making, I'm in the same boat as Esau is. All right. All right, this week, we're going to talk about, I'm going to take some time, read a little bit from 1 Samuel. Difficult story because there's a bunch of anachronisms in here. I finally gave up trying to piece it all together. The way the Hebrews tell stories and the way they write things down sometimes would frustrate us because we're so linear, we're so Greek and Western that everything's got to go in sequence, and they didn't always do that. So if you read this story, there'll be some things in it on your own that you'll think, I thought I just read this, or how, you know. So they kind of move things around. But this is in 1 Samuel. I'm just going to read a couple verses out of 17 and a little bit out of 20. This is right after Goliath loses his life to a young shepherd boy. All right, and the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." And as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. I just got to parenthetically say this is just, if you read this story, it's kind of bizarre. It's kind of like David's hauling Goliath's head around like a lunchbox or something. I mean, you'd think he would have hacked his head off and he would have laid it there, but it's kind of like he's walking around like this, and he says, "Oh, Saul wants to talk. Oh, yeah, I'll go." And so he walks over to talk to Saul. He's got Goliath's head in his hand. I'm thinking, how gross is this? You know, but so he does that, all right? As soon as David returned from striking down the Philistine, he brought him with the head of the Philistine in his hand, and Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I'm the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, all right, now I don't think it's this sentence. Saul wanted to know about him, and David had just had this amazing victory on behalf of Yahweh on the battlefield. And some of the stuff that David says here is absolutely staggering in terms of his commitment to God and his commitment to God's honor, all right? The warriors, the Jewish warriors had all heard this. Jonathan had heard this. Jonathan was one of Saul's lieutenants. He was a commander of 1,000 men. So he was a very, very important political and military figure. They had all heard David talk. So I don't want you to think that Jonathan just heard him say, "I'm the son of Jesse the Bethlehemite," and then this next part unfolds. He's sitting listening to David all morning. He watched him defeat Goliath, and now he's listening to him kind of debrief with the commander-in-chief here. soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day, would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant, a berith is the Hebrew word there, with David, because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him, gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. All right? That's a very, very important symbolic act there. Jonathan has basically done for David the thing that Saul tried to do. I don't know if you remember this, but Saul tried to give David his armor, if you've read this story. And that wasn't just, we'll get to this, but it wasn't just to protect David. Saul had a much different motive in mind for doing that. But David in here is symbolically deferring his heir apparent status to David. So there's some history here that we don't have. And he says in here that David and Jonathan and David were kindred spirits. His soul was knit to him. There's a beautiful word in Philippians chapter 2 when Paul's talking about Timothy. He says, I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, for I have no one else like him who will be genuinely concerned about your welfare. They all look out for their own interests and not those of Jesus Christ. I have no one else like him. My whole English phrase is the translation of one Greek word, and it's isosuke, and it basically means to share the same soul. And he says, I don't have anyone like Timothy. Our souls are, we're on the same page. We live for the same things. Timothy is more than just a disciple to me. And this is the same idea. This is not Greek, but same idea that's happening here. Okay, and we're going to jump ahead to 1 Samuel 20, and I'm going to jump around here a little bit. Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. This is after Saul tries to kill him a couple times. David tells Jonathan, your dad's trying to kill me. Jonathan says, I don't think so. He'd never do something without telling me. And so Jonathan's trying to really believe in his father at this point. The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness when I've sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day. Behold, if it's well disposed towards David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also if I do not disclose it to you and send you away that you may go in safety. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I'm still alive, show me the hesed love, the steadfast love of the Lord, that I may not die. That's covenant language right there. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. And Jonathan cut, is what the Hebrew says, Jonathan cut a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. And if you continue to read this story back and forth and back and forth, you hear this language about David making a covenant, or Jonathan making a covenant with David. And then when you get to the 2 Samuel at the very end, when Saul dies in battle and Jonathan and his brother Malchishua and his other brother, I think Abinadab, they all die with Saul that day. And David's lament is that the love of Jonathan was more pleasant and more meaningful than the love of a woman. And there's been some really twisted theology that's come out of that, some books, in fact. Everyone's looking for a hero in that community, and so they've taken this premier friendship in the scriptures and tried to say that this is obviously a statement about homosexual love. And the Hebrew word that's used for sexual relationship, yada, which is the word to know, is never ever used in the relationship between David and Jonathan. The Hebrew word for love that's used here is the same word that's used throughout the entire story, and I'll show you that in a second. It's consistent. But it does lay before us an amazing portrait of friendship that I'd like to spend some time on. I spent quite a bit of time this weekend talking to Jill about this, because I'll be real honest with you, and I'm not sure what your thoughts are on this or how honest you are in this whole area, but we when it comes to understanding and living as biblical friends. Men, for whatever reason, have a terrible time with this. There's tons of books that have been written about us as men not being able to really have the kind of intimate friendships with other men that women sometimes are able or more easily. There's a book called Bowling Alone. There's a book called The Friendless American Male. I mean, people have written on this and done lots of studies on it. And the truth is, when I think of the people that really know my heart, it's really, really tiny. I've got a lot of people that would consider me friends because of what I do and how long they've known me. But in terms of really the kind of thing that you see here between David and Jonathan, I just, you know, I really don't have that. And you get to be 59, it gets pretty hard to start developing those kinds of relationships. It just is. So those guys that are younger, you have probably more to learn this morning than those of us that are on the last lap here. All right. Let's take a look at Jonathan. I want to take a look at what we've done before, the world behind the text, and we'll look at some other scriptures. And I put in here a godly friend from an ungodly home. I think one of the things that's really cool here that just flies in the face of modern psychology, and you see this consistently, there is no explanation for a guy like Jonathan. His dad was a twit. I mean, Saul was just an awful, awful father. I mean, he went crazy. God pulled his Holy Spirit off of Saul's life and he went mad. That should sober us about walking with God. Not that we can lose the Holy Spirit, but walking progressively away from the Lord is not a good path. And Jonathan grew up in this home. And there's even a line in here where he just basically almost uses the Hebrew language that he uses about Jonathan is such a disparaging thing about his own mother. It's kind of like, you're the child of a slut anyway. You know, he gets really mad at him about David, tries to kill Jonathan himself. And then you have a guy like this come out of a home like that. Just reinforces that there is no formula, regardless of who you read. There's no formula for raising children. There's some principles for sure. But I saw this teaching. I saw godly kids come out of ungodly homes. I saw some of the neatest parents in the world have their hearts broken for long periods of time because they had a kid that you just, where'd this guy come from? And I gave up long ago thinking, well, there's just something really wrong in that home that no one knows about. No, it's just, Adam and Eve had perfect parents and they didn't turn out so good either. So let's take a look at this word aheb, this word love. I put in your notes, everybody loved David. David was everyone's poster child, all right? Saul loved him, and I put quotes around those that aren't real, for how he made Saul look. David was great for the military. Everywhere he went, he won. And for Saul, and this is what you got to get, for Saul to put, we know that David was, he wasn't tiny. He was young, but he wasn't tiny. You don't kill a bear and a lion and be a little wimp. You're not my, he wasn't my size, all right? He was a mighty warrior, so much so that God wouldn't even let him build the temple because he had so much blood on his hands. So he was a fighter. But he's young here. He's ruddy is the word that's used, which means he hadn't shaved yet. He was probably in his late teens or a teenager when he killed Goliath. But Saul wants to put his armor on him, tries to put his tunic and his armor and his sword and all this. And it's not because he's thinking, my son, I don't want you to get hurt. He's because he would have found something that fit him. David said, I can't even walk in this stuff, you know, so he took it off. If David had worn Saul's armor to go out to fight Goliath, all right, this was what was known as a contest of champions. You bring your best guy out. We'll bring our best guy out. He just happens to be about 8 feet tall. And whoever wins, wins on behalf of the respective armies. It was not uncommon in ancient literature that they did this. All right? This is not a duel. This is not two guys fighting for each other's honor. This is two guys each representing, You know, there was a commercial. As a matter of fact, there was a commercial back in my hippie days on television, and there was two guys, probably 70 years old, with suits on, that came walking out into the middle of this room and just started duking it out. They were actors, but they just started fighting, like just punching each other and all this. And underneath it, it was an anti-war thing. Underneath it, it said, "Wouldn't it be great if wars were fought this way?" All right. Well, that's what this is. This is a duel of champions. So if David had put on Saul's armor and Saul's tunic and used Saul's sword, Saul would have been credited with the victory that day. All right. And by chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, we've already seen Saul's true colors. He's already turned out to be the absolute epitome of a people pleaser. He can't make decisions unless it's going to make him look good in the face of his soldiers. All right, he doesn't kill Agag the Amalekite, doesn't kill the best sheep, because he says, Samuel comes and says, "What are you doing? You're supposed to kill all this stuff." And he said, "Oh, I saved the best for God." And then he finally gets to the bottom of it, and he says, "Well, I was afraid of the people, and so I gave in to them. I've sinned. I violated the Lord's command and your instruction. I was afraid of the people, so I gave in to them." All right? And so this is the kind of character he is. And he's trying to use David as a political pawn to make himself look good. He loved him for that. All right? Second person, all of Israel, it says. All of Israel and Judah loved David. And if you read the context of it, it's because of the victories that he had in battle. It was for what he did for them as a nation. Provided political security and peace for them. All right, so they loved him for it. it's kind of like I was born and raised in Wisconsin, and my wife was born and raised in Minnesota. So the fact that Brett Favre is playing for the Vikings right now is a real interesting set of events. But I can tell you, and this wouldn't surprise you, there's some not so nice feelings going on in Wisconsin right now. There's a bar right across from Lambeau Field that every time Brett Favre has an interception, the drinks are on the house. So, you know, because everybody loved Brett when he was playing for Green Bay, but now that he's playing for Minnesota, then you'd have to, this is Alabama Auburn. You need to know this. If you lived in the upper Midwest and you were from Wisconsin, the goal of the whole football season was to beat the Vikings, all right? And if the Vikings beat the Packers and the Vikings were going to the Super Bowl, then everybody in Minnesota and Wisconsin's passion was that they beat the Bears. You know, so it's like your allegiance is with your state, but then if that has to dissolve, then your allegiance is with the upper Midwest versus the kind of the lower Midwest. And this is kind of what you have here. You've got a nation that's really excited as long as David's winning. And he happens to have a winning season, all right? Michael, Saul's daughter, that was given to him for the price. I mean, I don't know what you'd feel like if you were a woman, but the dowry was 100 Philistine foreskins. That's what Saul said. That's what I want for my daughter. So David brought 200. But if you read Saul's discussion here, he's hoping that Michael will ensnare David. So there had to have been something about this sweet little thing in his growing up in his home that he understood about her, that she would bring a little difficulty into his life. And she loved David as long as he met her expectations. When he didn't act the way she wanted him to act, she didn't love him anymore. As a matter of fact, he came the day that they were bringing the ark into Jerusalem. He's dancing and flying all over the place and just, he's so excited, and Michael looks out the window and says she despised him in his heart because she felt he was making a fool out of himself. Kings don't do this. Jonathan loved David because of what he had done and would do for Yahweh. That the basis of Jonathan's love for him, he sits in this field and he listens to David challenge Goliath in the name of God, because Goliath had maligned God's honor. And he doesn't really talk much about the national identity of national Israel. He talks about what he had done to God. And Jonathan heard all that. And if you follow the story through, it's difficult to tell when it happened, because in 18, when he transfers his armor and stuff to him, it seems like he'd already made up his mind at this point. But the lights go on either slowly or whatever, but at some point, Jonathan absolutely knows for sure that David's the next king. And his allegiance is with God and what God's going to do with David. Costly thing, by the way, something that we're not going to get into here. But Jonathan has a counterpart in the New Testament whose name is also John, and that's John the Baptizer. And you have one characteristic of genuine friendship, and I didn't put it in the notes, but a characteristic of genuine friendship is that a genuine friend does everything in their power to help the other person succeed. And John the Baptizer did that. I must decrease, he must increase. He was the hottest thing since sliced bagels. There hadn't been a voice from God in 400 years, and he had this immense following, and he knew that his whole purpose was to prepare the way for the one that was coming after him. And so when the one got here, he turned the direction of his entire ministry. He basically sent everybody that direction. And that's where they all ended up eventually. Not all at once, but they all eventually, all the followers of John ended up being followers of Yeshua. So you see that here. You see Jonathan setting his heart to make David a success. And he stood to lose more than anyone else. All right, he stood to lose the love and support of his father. We're going to get to that. And he also, obviously, stood to lose the throne. He was the heir apparent. He was the crown prince. He was the, even though it had not been carved in granite yet in Hebrew culture, because Saul was their first king, it was reasonable that he would be the next king. And he was willing to pass that by because he knew that God had different plans for his life and David's life. He was right on everything except one thing. He told David, "There's going to come a point when you're going to be king, and I'm going to be there next to you." He didn't know he's going to die with his dad on the battlefield. All right, but Jonathan loved David, I think, for what he saw in David. How else can you explain that he's listening to David recount what happened on that field that day? And we know it wasn't, a female sports analyst with a microphone in his face saying, "How did it feel?" I mean, this was all about revenge, right? I mean, how did it feel, to take off his head? It wasn't that kind of stupid thing. You've got David recounting his allegiance to Yahweh and the honor of God, and it says that Jonathan heard that, and his soul was knit to him, and he loved him like his own soul. So they had to have been drawn to this spiritual aspect in David's life, all right? But then Jonathan's faced with a choice here. I put Saul's way or Yahweh. You watch this progression or digression, and it's really sad if you think about it. Don't think about that this is just a Bible story, but think about this as a family. Think about this as a father and a son. If you've got sons, think of this playing itself out in your own home. And you find out three things here. Saul knew that Yahweh was with David and had left him. We see that two places. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him but had departed from Saul. And then later on, about five chapters later, or five verses later, when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Saul was paranoid, obviously, in terms of his position with the nation, but he also had a terrible problem with the fact that God was with David and he wasn't with him. But he took that a step further, and he believed that Jonathan was also with David and not with him, and had left him. Not only God had left him, but his own son had left him. And you see that in a really bitter statement that comes out of his mouth. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. He said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you've chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness?" Mother's nakedness there is best understood as a phrase to the woman that bore you. You've chosen David, you've chosen a shepherd as opposed to the royal house of your father, to your shame. You've married, in a sense, it's the kind of thing where you've married way below what you should. you're associating with somebody. You're disgracing me. You're disgracing our family. You're disgracing your mother. And he accuses Jonathan of switching jerseys. All right. And the thing that's tragic is that, and this is an amazing thing, Jonathan is able to maintain his fidelity to his father, his fidelity to Yahweh, and his fidelity to David all at the same time, and dies in battle side by side with his dad, who God has abandoned about 10 chapters earlier, doesn't break any of the covenant relationships that he made with David, which is just mind-blowing. He's just an amazing person. But the point that I want to get to here, this third point, is that David and Jonathan were beloved friends because they both were with Yahweh, not because they were with each other. The basis and the beauty and the depth and the cohesion of their relationship was not that they were just, that their souls were knit to each other. Their souls were knit to the same thing, all right? Two things in close proximity to one thing are in proximity to each other. And that's the thing, and this is true in every relationship, but the closer two people come to the same point, it's like a triangle, the sides of a triangle going up, the closer they get to one another. It's true in marriage. My intimacy with my wife and her intimacy with me is ultimately dependent upon our individual intimacy with Yahweh, with God. Closer I draw to the Father, the closer she draws to the Father, we find ourselves drawing closer to one another. We're going to talk about that. But that's really what you have here. It's not just a couple guys hanging out after work down at Dave's Pub or going fishing in the on the Gulf Coast or going to the mountains hunting together every weekend. It's not. This isn't a hunting club. It's not a fishing club. It's not a fraternity. All right. This is two men whose both of their hearts are solely given over to the Lord, and it's what drew them together. All right. Very different people. One thing they had in common is they both apparently like to kill people. All right. Friendship by the book. I want to go through this because this is some stuff that's a little bit edgy, but it's important for us to, I think, to look at because it's in the text. All right, and it's in the scriptures. When forced, when pushed against the wall, all right, Jonathan chose hesed. That's the Hebrew word for God's steadfast love. He uses that word a bunch in chapter 20, over heredity. The faithful over family. In terms of his hierarchy, David put his allegiance to God and his allegiance to David over his allegiance to his father, or his relationship is probably a better word. He was willing to have his father be angry at him for choosing what was right than he was to have his father's blessing and live with a violated conscience. Jonathan knew that God's hand was on David. He'd come to that conclusion. He knew that he was the next king of Israel, and he knew that God had left his father. And he ends up siding with David. And Saul, so Saul was right in that assessment. All right, Jesus made this choice, the requirement of true discipleship. You see this in at least two places in Scripture. One of them's in Matthew 12, where Jesus says, "Who are my mother and my sister and my brothers?" You know, they're the ones that do the will of God. That's who my mother and sisters are. That's my real family. And he talks about it again in a little bit different vein in Luke chapter 12, the references I've given you there. And the one in Luke 12 actually is very, very controversial and very offensive. Jesus said, "I did not come to bring peace, but I came to bring fire on the earth." And he said that the enemies of one's enemies are going to be the members of their own household. The day is coming when in a house of five, three are going to be against two, and two are going to be against three. A son's going to be against his father, and the children against their parents. And he says a mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law. And he goes through this long list of interfamilial relationships. And he said, that's what's going to happen with people who side with me. And so there's this notion that the real family for a believer is those that are committed to the plans and purposes of Yahweh, all right? This third point is absolutely enormous, and this would be the thing I would really want us to camp on this morning, and that's that the direction that friends take me and I take them, the direction is God's primary concern in friendship. Deuteronomy 13, this is a very powerful, powerful passage. If your brother, the son of your mother, or your son, or your daughter, or the wife you embrace, or your friend who is as your own soul, there's David and Jonathan, entices you secretly saying, let us go and serve other gods, which neither you nor your fathers have known, some of the gods of the people that are around you, whether near or far off, from one end of the earth to the other. You shall not yield to him or listen to him. Your eyes shall not pity him. You shall not spare him, nor shall you conceal him, but you shall kill him. All right? Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards his hand of all the people. And then he basically said that the nation's going to hear this and they're going to be sobered. All right? Now, we're on the other side of that kind of lex talionis, that kind of retributive justice and purging and purity. But you have in here a principle that's absolutely enormous, and that's that God is deeply concerned about the direction that people are taking us and the direction we are taking our friends. All right? You see this repeatedly. The companion of fools suffers harm, but he who walks with the wise will become wise. Paul said in 1 Corinthians, don't be mocked, or God is not mocked. Bad company spoils good character. And you look at Paul's instruction to Timothy about you flee all these things and then you pursue along with others righteousness and this sort of stuff. And so God's very, very concerned about the direction that relationships are carrying his covenant people. All right, this is not just a blanket statement for Barnes & Noble, some guy having a latte. This is for us as believers. I think the principle holds. All right, shared values and purpose. Shared values and purpose, my reason for living, are essential in good friendships. Shared interests are not. They're helpful. They make for easy conversation. They make for easy planning. But shared interests are not the basis of the essential basis for friendship, biblical friendship. Shared purpose and direction are. I put a verse in there, Amos 3:3. Do two walk together unless they are in agreement? Other versions say, do two walk together unless they've agreed to meet? Do two walk together unless they have an appointment? This is not a stroll in the park. Right? This is not the guys that you get up at 5 in the morning with and jog through whatever. You know, this is two people going on a journey, is what they're talking about. And you don't go on a journey with somebody unless you've agreed on the route, the destination, and the essentials that you need to carry. And that's what he's really talking about. He's talking here about you can't be intimate and a real friend with someone if the path you're on is forking. If you're going this way with your life and this person's going this way with your life, Amos says you can't walk together. You can love that person. You can't have that kind of Jonathan-David relationship with them. So the direction that we take our friends, the directions that our friends take us, and in fact the direction that our relationship together is going is vital. All right. And true relationship, true friendships based on two, and this is really important. I hinted at this earlier. It's based on two separate accountabilities to God, not a shared accountability to each other. Accountability is a big buzzword right now, particularly on the college campus. There's all this talk about accountability groups and accountability partners and all this sort of stuff. In my experience with it, and this is a sweeping statement, you know, broad brush on a small canvas, but my experience with it has been that it's a bunch of guys getting together and barfing on each other, kind of telling all the garbage that they've done, and they pray together and go off. That's not accountability. You know, accountabilities need to have some teeth. It needs to be something that you're scared spitless to have to deal with this person because you violated the covenant that you've set up. The person's going to look at you and say, you idiot! What are you doing? You know, it's not like, oh, brother, you know, let's pray. It's, you know, there's a 14th century monk that says, basically talking about accountability, it says the fire that will burn you most severely, run to it. That's what he's talking about in terms of keeping each other accountable. Their friendship, the basis of their accountability, was two separate accountabilities to God, not this idea of a shared accountability to one another. All right? And that's enormous. That's what we're going to look at, and we'll close with this. But you and I, in terms of our friendships, if we have any, all right, We have to be convinced in our heart that there's a sense of accountability before God Himself in terms of my relationship with my friend, that I have to give an account someday for my relationship with my friend. It's not that we are going to be accountable to one another. I'm accountable to God for myself, obviously, but I'm accountable to God for him. And he's accountable to God for me. All right, we're going to look at some of the ways that that's true here. Number one, I think Proverbs 17:17. Proverbs is the two things about Proverbs. One, you have to be a little bit careful because it's really written. It's the only book in the Bible written for kids. But it's got great stuff in it for us as adults. But it's written for a father wrote it for his son. But the best book in the Bible on getting along with people. Just basic aphorisms, you know, they're proverbs, so they're not always true. Some they're true most of the time. You got to be careful what you do with them. But they're, you know, so the friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. That's the human side of one of the most beautiful Hebrew words in the Old Testament that we can't even translate it. It's just got nothing. I mean, if you read Bibles, it's loving kindness, his faithfulness, his steadfast love. That's one word in the Old Testament that you read different versions and it's all over the place because they're trying to figure out how to put it into English. But it's the word for God's covenant love. And that's the word that's used over and over in 1 Samuel 20. Show the steadfast love of the Lord to me. And a true friend, a biblical friend, is a friend that loves at all times. All right. And that doesn't always mean quiet, passive, agreement with of my friend's lifestyle, but it does mean that I don't bail on my friends. All the years I spent in Christian education, it was interesting to me. No matter where I taught, I always came across families that refused to let their children or themselves associate with anyone that had failed. They always wanted to be around successful people. I knew a girl that tried to kill herself, and her two closest friends, their parents, made their daughters quit hanging around with this girl. They couldn't be associated with her, couldn't hang around with her. That's not Hesed love. Hesed love is love that goes the distance. All right. Second, to point out sin that my friend doesn't see that I do. And this one makes us nervous, but it's a testimony of the lack of depth and intimacy in our friendships. You guys, there's a verse, and I put it in your notes here, Hebrews 3:13, exhort one another every day as long as it's called today. The idiom there is as long as there's still time, is what that means, as long as there's still time, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Right above that it says, be careful that no evil, unbelieving heart spring up in you, and you become bitter. And by your bitterness, other people are defiled. But instead, as long as there's still time, exhort one another every single day, lest they be hardened. That's the hardening that causes the bitterness by this deceitfulness of sin. What does that mean? The key thing here for us as men is that there is sin in our lives that we just don't see. We don't see it. There's two ways we don't see it. One, we just flat out don't see it. There's areas of our life that we're blind to. It goes back to this Adamic residue we talked about. We have concluded that that's just the way that God made me. I'm just like that. I'm just a burly, brusque, insensitive person. That's how God made me. There's that. There's also not seeing the seriousness of something. It's not that big a deal. Compared to this, this, and this, this is not that big a deal. And what God is saying here is that if it's deceitful, that means that it's able to work its work without me being aware of it. But guess what? If David and I are deep friends in this sense, and he sees it and I don't see it, this scripture says he has a biblical responsibility to point that out to me. That's what the word exhort means. All right? And there's a bunch of other principles that we can't get into. He needs to be careful that he's not tempted and falls into the same sin. That's what it says in Galatians. He can't do it in an arrogant sense. There needs to be kind of a fear and trepidation and almost like, I don't want to do this, but I can't sleep at night. I got to go do this. I'll go to the grave regretting not getting on a plane and flying to Tucson or Phoenix about 20 years ago because of a dear friend of mine whose marriage was in trouble. And God just kept prompting me to go, and I didn't go. And I saw it, and I didn't go. And now they're divorced. That's a mess now. And it's not, I can't do anything about it. Would that have made a difference? I don't know. But that's the problem. I don't know anymore. This is vital. And in an American culture where it's to pull yourself, we're the Marlboro men, you know. We're the guys that don't need anyone. We're the ones that don't bond and don't, you know. And this is really, in a litigious society, this is we get scared to do stuff like this as well. So I'm not talking about us being the God squad. I'm talking about people that are our closest friends. There are things in my life that need to be pointed out. There are things in your life that need to be pointed out. There are things in your friend's life. True friend does this, all right? Model obedience, especially when it's costly. There's a great verse in Psalms. I am a friend to all who fear you. All right? The fear of the Lord in the Hebraic mind was faithfulness to the covenant. That's all it was. It was obedience. It wasn't an emotion. All right? We don't talk much about obedience in America anymore because it's legalism. Legalism has become a euphemism for disobedience in our culture. You talk to people, well, that sounds legalistic to me. No, it's just obedience. God's God. He's still got the name tag, G-O-D. You just do what he says. You know, that's all. And modeling obedience. Our friends need to see us obey God when it costs, when it hurts, when it's hard. Not just all the time in general. And I think that's what the psalmist is saying here. I'm a friend to all who fear you, to those who follow your precepts. To nurture the spiritual growth of my friend in word and deed. This is such a beautiful thing. It says that Jonathan went and found David and strengthened his hand in God at a time when his own father was trying to kill him. Jonathan sought him out, strengthened his hand in God. All right. What do you think that meant? I don't know what he'd said to him. I feel fairly sure I know what he didn't say. I don't think he said, you know, all things work together for good. Or this is all going to work itself out. You know, or there's a cloud or a rainbow behind every cloud, or every cloud has a silver lining. I don't think it was something glib. I picture them praying together. I picture them talking about something about the faithfulness of God and the plan of God for his life. Maybe reminding him. And he does in there. He says, my dad knows that you're going to be the next king. All right, so that means Jonathan knew that. Now, that's a big spiritual deal for Jonathan to say that, because that's not the natural course of events. So Jonathan has submitted himself to God's plan, which is tanking his chances. We talked about this, and the fact that his father is not going to be set up a dynasty. Letter E, spending face-to-face time with my friends. I could go off on this for an hour. Technology, social networking, and informational technologies in this culture are destroying relationships. They're redefining what it means to be a human being. And you've got a whole generation coming up that thinks that friends, that you can have 100 friends, because that's how many names you have on your Facebook page. And they don't know how to talk across the lunchroom table or the person next door. And I'm not the loudest, clearest voices on this are coming from outside the church, not from inside the church. We're still caught up in the novelty of trying to figure out how to get Twitter into our worship services. So, but there's a lot that's shaping. There's what I call technological tectonics going on right now. It's as big as the continent shifting in terms of what it means to be a human being and how human beings relate to one another. And beloved, we are made for face-to-face relationships. We're made in the image of a God that relates to himself that way. John 1:1 says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was pros hatheos. The Word was with the God. And the preposition pros means proximity. And the Son left a face-to-face relationship with the Father to enter into a face-to-face relationship with the human race, because we're made in the image of a God that relates that way. And you see this throughout Scripture. That verse I have, thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face-to-face as a man speaks to a friend. 2 John 12, I have much more to write to you, but I'd rather not use pen and ink. I'd rather not text. I'd rather not email. I hope to come to you that we might speak face to face so that our joy may be complete. All right. Look at 1 Corinthians 13. You've heard this verse 1,000 times. Now we see in a mirror dimly. Then we shall see What's the rest of it? Face to face. Yeah? And you know what that phrase is, face to face? Prosopos, pros, prosopos. It's kind of face to face to face to face to face to face. It's just like this concentrated, you know. And we've got a culture that honestly believes they can relate pixel to pixel. And I promise you, it is going to we haven't even begun to see the social deterioration that's going to come from that. That's not to mention the stupidity. My son, that's a graphic design professor, he's Mr. Tolerant. He said, "Dad, the reason my students are so stupid, I've never heard him say this before, is because of social networking." He said, "They'll spend 3 hours keeping in touch with their friends on Facebook at night, but I can't get them to spend 2 hours on an art project. And the written work they give me, they don't capitalize, they don't use commas, I talked to an English professor in college that got a research paper or a written assignment from a college sophomore that used emoticons, you know, the little smileys and all this stuff in the paper in college, and thought they were being kind of cute. Anyway, have strong feelings about that. I've watched it, and we've got to be as far as none of this stuff's evil. But is not, we are not, there's nothing in our culture. The Adamic remnant is moving out of the garden, and any technological innovation is going to be designed to make the journey more comfortable. And as a Christian, if I don't accept that fact, I got my head in my armpit. I just do. Steve Jobs, when he invented the iPhone, wasn't sitting around thinking, this is going to draw people to God. It's going to draw people back together. The research is in, the jury's in on this, and we've got a disconnected culture because of this, all right? There's a great quote, Quentin Schultz, Habits of the High-Tech Heart. That's the only Christian book I know on the market that deals with this in an intelligent fashion. All right. To give and heed on and godly counsel. Important thing. Godly counsel isn't proverbial conventional wisdom. It's not what the market will leads us to conclude. It's really what's ultimately in their best interest spiritually. It might mean moving. It might mean changing jobs. It might mean something that's very countercultural. Another thing I didn't put down here, but I think it's important, is to pray for and pray with my friend. 1 Samuel 12:23. Far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you. Far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you. And I will instruct you and teach you in the way that is right. That's what Samuel said to the people. All right. Okay, three things. Let's wrap this up. Put this in front of I put here the folly of Facebook, all right, when it comes to friendship. First point, companions. This is based on Webster's idea. Companions are people we spend time with, we have shared interests with, or shared experiences, shared history, common history, all right? Friends, biblically, are those that are committed to the six characteristics above. Companions, the people that I hang with, the people I spend time with, people that I've got a shared history with, went to high school, fraternity brothers, went to college with, we've worked together, live in the same neighborhood, are not necessarily friends. All right, friends have the characteristics that we looked at above. Question for us, how many of my friends are really friends? How many friends do I have? How many people are there in my life that point out sin, that pray for me, pray with me, give me counsel, that are concerned about my spiritual life? You know, Ephesians 4:29, beautiful verse, let no corrupting talk, and this is in your notes, but let no corrupting talk come out of your mouth, but only such that builds others up, that fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who listen. That's just having in mind, I want to help my brother grow in the Lord. I want to move him along in his Christian life. And I'm thinking that way. This isn't super spiritual stuff unless it's not really part of the normal fabric of my life. Then it becomes super spiritual. But if it's just kind of who I am. And you guys know people like this. And I think God's desire is that we be people like this. Second, friendships are not neutral. They aren't. They're either moving me towards God or they're moving me away from God. And I'm not saying they're making me less godly, but they either are moving me in the direction of Christ-likeness or they're moving me the opposite direction, and sometimes that just means keeping me where I am because it neutralizes the positive growth that's occurring in my life. A person's negative influence doesn't appear negative because I'm not going backwards, but I'm not going anywhere. If I'm not going anywhere because of a relationship, then it's got to be nullifying other positive influences in my life. And the direction we take people. This is big to God. That Deuteronomy 13 passage, you guys, is not a small passage. It's not one of those biblical speed bumps. There's a lot of ink devoted to relationships. Which direction are my friends taking me? I have this thing called primary and secondary friends. I don't know if it's biblical, and I certainly would not die for it. I don't even want to get beat up for it, but I think it's true that my primary friends are friends whose influence on me is greater than or equal to my influence on them. And secondary friends are friends in which my influence is greater than their influence on me. And I think the danger for us as believing men is that our primary friends are not only unbelievers, but they're either unbelievers or they're nominal Christians. And our secondary friends are people that are probably more serious about their relationship with Jesus. And I think it needs to be the other way around. I think our primary friends, the people that really speak and act into my life, need to be people that are on this journey either with me or they're on the journey that I really want to be on even though I'm struggling. I got to have these people around me. People that whose their very life is either calling me to account or calling me up to a higher way of living. And I don't see this as guilty. We do this in business, you know. I know that in certain professionals' training that some of you in this room, as you went up, you were told about how to make sure you associate yourself with certain people for professional reasons. So we know the principle there. This is just so much more important. Third one, my wife can either be my companion, sharing the task of raising children, etc., or she can be my friend, committed to the same journey. And I guess the question here is, you know, how is your friendship with your spouse? If you're married, is she a companion? Is she a friend? And God's, I think, you know, she's our. You're supposed to love your neighbor, and your wife is your closest neighbor. That's what Luther said, Martin Luther. And I think one of the things for us is to make sure we nurture a friendship with our spouse. I'm convinced that one of the reasons, not the reason, but one of the main reasons that a lot of marriages fail when people are my age, 25, 30 years into marriage, is because they've been companions their whole life and never developed a real deep sense of friendship, someone that you just want to be with. If you had to pick between this and this, she would always be the first pick. And raising children is really a narcotic because it numbs you into thinking that you really are much more than companions, but it's just a shared task of raising kids, and it's the longest chapter of your life. If you're not there yet, and if some of you are in the middle of it, but it's 25, 26 year chapter. It's a long one, and I'm on the other side of it, kind of, and so. Evaluate the relationships in your life. If you don't have a friend, then begin to pray that God would bring one in your life, or if there's someone that you'd like to talk to that you have the budding friendship with that you want it to be more, talk to them. And especially the thing with your wife. And if this stuff's not working in your life right now, at least begin to pray. Just say, God, make me this kind of person. Make me this kind of person. And age is not as crucial as you think. I mean, it doesn't have to be someone that's the same age, same graduation year. I've seen that some amazing friendships that are a decade apart, just people that are shared values and purpose. So Jonathan's a cool guy. Let me